The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
We're going to go ahead and get everything started. My name is Kellen Clemens. I am the Roundtable Live Director for the Legislation and Policy Roundtable, who are putting on this wonderful event today. And I am charged with giving the formal introductions to our panelists. To my right is Professor Jeffrey Lubbers, Fellow in Law and Government here at the American University Washington College of Law. Prior to joining us here, he served in various positions with the Administrative Conference of the United States, particularly as Research Director. In addition to teaching, he has served as a consultant to various federal agencies, the ABA, the World Bank, and the USAID. Further down is Mr. Jeff Mahoney, who is the counsel for the Council of Institutional Investors. He is also an adjunct faculty member here at the Washington College of Law. And he currently co-chairs the FASB's Investors Technical Advisory Committee and is vice chair of the Investors Rights Committee of the Corporation Finance and Securities Law Section of the D.C. Bar. And on the end is Commissioner Sarah Raskin, Maryland's Commissioner of Financial Regulation. Commissioner Raskin has also been banking counsel to the Senate Banking Committee. She has also worked at both the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the Joint Economic Committee of Congress. And immediately to my right is the Editor-in-Chief of the Legislation and Policy Roundtable, who will be moderating the panel, Ms. Tiana Butcher.
I want to thank you all for coming. I appreciate you taking the time to join us. Just to give you a little bit of the layout of how our panel discussion will go, we'll have five-minute introductory presentations by each of our speakers, and 5 minutes if they choose afterwards for responses to everybody else's presentation, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So with no further ado, I will introduce Professor Jeff Lubbers.
Thank you, Tiana and Kellen and the roundtable for inviting me to participate in this. I'm not sure I can do my introduction in 5 minutes. But I will try. And so this is sort of March Madness, Washington, D.C. style, I think, although I think in Washington we'd have to change the name to March Bipolar Disorder, probably. But I was listening to NPR last night, and they had a debate, an Oxford-style debate, on whether or not the financial crisis was more the fault of Washington, D.C. or Wall Street. And the vote was 60 to 40 for Washington, D.C. So we'll see what we think about after today's panel. So we have some real experts on the panel. I'm really not one in terms of financial regulation per se, but so I thought I'd try to give you a little overview of the current situation that we find ourselves in, and then I'm going to make some comments about the proposed reorganization of the Federal Financial Services regulatory agencies. So in the outline that I distributed, I provided some bullet points on some of the difficult issues that the Obama administration faces as they are trying to deal with the situation, largely holdover from the previous administration. So, you know, we've got the meltdown of the banking industry that occurred last fall, triggered by the collapse of the housing bubble and the wave of foreclosures. Of subprime mortgages, and these subprime mortgages have been securitized around the world, mostly by the largely unregulated investment banking companies that actually no longer exist anymore, like Morgan Stanley, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, all of which have ceased to exist in their former form, at least. That caused a severe downturn in the stock markets, which have led to severe reductions in tax receipts by state and local governments, as people have sustained capital losses rather than capital gains. That's created a recession in the basic economy that's been fueled by this massive loss of wealth in stock investments, lower property values, job and housing losses, and lower consumer confidence and spending. Then we have, as a result of that, a large growth in the already bulging federal deficit that was inherited from the Bush administration, and according to the CBO, is going to get a lot worse. We also have, I think, seen the need to do the uncomfortable but generally accepted thing of infusing banks and other large, too-big-to-fail companies like AIG and General Motors with government money to keep them afloat. And then this has created an economic recession around the world, which has led to the recurrence of direct and indirect new trade barriers, which will probably make it harder to achieve recovery. So what's the Obama administration doing about this? Well, first, it supported what the Bush administration did with respect to the bailout legislation, the so-called TARP program that was created by that legislation, which authorized a $700 billion fund originally to buy up toxic assets, these subprime mortgages and related securities owned by banks. When it became clear that it was almost impossible to value these assets, the Treasury Department decided that it would make direct investments in these banks to help keep them solvent. Also, President Bush then expanded the program to allow him to invest in companies like General Motors, which he did. Meanwhile, the Federal Reserve Board was undertaking in a much less visible way, using its power to print money to provide huge transfusions into other ailing financial concerns like AIG and Citigroup. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation was taking over certain banks that had been failing, about 30 of them. And there was another program that was created it's called the Term Asset Backed Securities Loan Facility, which is attempting to try to get consumer lending going again with a huge fund of up to $1 trillion to give to lenders in those areas. Well, this all happened before January 20th. So when Secretary Geithner took over, he had half the TARP funds to use. And he first came up with kind of a vague plan that was criticized by the stock markets and everybody else. And then last week he gave more details, which was basically a public-private investment plan with two parts. One was to buy up, buyers to buy up these kinds of residential loans that were in the bank's portfolios. And so the government is going to guarantee 85% of those loans. And the second one was a much larger program to create three mostly federally funded competing entities that investors could invest in that would bid in sort of an auction format to price these so-called toxic assets, these securitized mortgages. Now, all these actions are essentially intended to shore up the banking industry, to unfreeze the commercial credit market, to get banks back into the credit market. We'll see how this works in the future, although, unfortunately, this firestorm that was created over the large bonuses paid out to AIG executives and certain banks has kind of obscured some of this. The second major Obama initiative was, of course, the stimulus package. This was passed in February with no Republican votes in the House and three Republican votes in the Senate. It devotes $787 billion to stimulate the economy. About 37% of that package is tax cuts, 18% goes to state and local governments, and 45% to federal social programs and spending programs. Meanwhile, of course, he had to worry about the funding the basic machinery of the federal government and the appropriation bills. So the first was the holdover from 2009. Which hadn't been passed. So that was finally passed last March, $410 billion. It was criticized for having a lot of earmarks. President Obama criticized the earmarks too, but he said, I'm not going to block it because it was last year's bill. But he said, in the future, I'm going to try to prevent these sorts of earmarks. Well, now we're in the process of trying to get the 2010 fiscal year budget through the Congress, and one of the problems, and this was when President Obama issued his budget, the Congressional Budget Office said this is going to create really huge, massive deficits. And one of the reasons is that President Obama actually put the Iraq and Afghanistan war into the budget, unlike President Bush, who was using supplemental budgetary devices to fund those wars. So that's the second. The third is he rolled out his ideas for the dramatic change in the federal regulatory system for regulating financial services. Now, Treasury Secretary Paulson got this started in the Bush administration, but his approach was trying to sort of increase, essentially, to streamline the regulation and essentially actually deregulate more than regulate. And after last fall's event, this wasn't events, this wasn't going to work. So the Obama administration has come up with its own plan for stronger and more effective regulation. But in order to understand that, we need to understand the current financial services regulatory framework. And in my outline, I set forth all the different entities out there that are regulating federal financial services, the industry. So we've got this dual banking system, and we have one of the representatives in Sarah Raskin who regulates banks in the state of Maryland. So all commercial and savings banks in the United States have the choice of being regulated by the state, a state, or the federal government. And if it's a bank, that would mean the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, OCC, part of the Treasury Department. If it's a savings and loan, a thrift, it would be regulated by the Office of Thrift Supervision, also in the Treasury Department. But the great majority of America's 8,000 banks are regulated and chartered by states. So we've got the OCC and the OTS and the IRS, all within the Treasury Department. Then we've got a whole series of independent agencies that are involved as well. The most powerful, of course, is the Federal Reserve Board, which is the U.S. central bank. It has control over the money supply. It's taken an increasing role in the bailout activities that I mentioned before, but it also has supervisory responsibility for those state-chartered banks that are members of the Federal Reserve System. It also regulates bank holding companies, companies that own banks. And it regulates the foreign activities of member banks and the U.S. activities of foreign banks. So the Fed and its 12 regional Federal Reserve banks supervise about 900 state member banks and 5,000 bank holding companies. Then we've got the FDIC, which guarantees your deposits in the banks, up to $250,000 now. Well, they also have some supervisory role over the banks in order to make sure that they're not taking unnecessary risks. And if a bank goes insolvent, then they have a fund to take over that bank. And in the last year and a half, they've taken over about 30 U.S. banks. This is paid out of insurance premiums paid by the banks. Then we've got credit unions, which are regulated by the National Credit Union Administration. Then we've got GSEs, government-sponsored enterprises, like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which try to insure loans that banks pay to people who want to buy houses. Residential mortgage borrowing segment. So this is a very large part of this area. And the three financial services GSEs, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the 12 federal home loan banks around the United States have huge assets, and these are backed by the full faith and credit of the United States government. So Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac basically became bankrupt in the last year. And there's a new agency that was created to regulate them called
OFAIL, is for short.
OFAIL, Office of Federal Housing Board.
Enterprise.
It's a new board now. Wait a second. I have it in my notes somewhere. There's a new agency that does it. It's a brand new agency, an independent agency that regulates Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Just last year it was announced that Freddie Mac lost $50 billion last year. So that's another huge drain on the economy. I haven't even mentioned, you probably noticed, the SEC or the CFTC, which also regulate securities and commodities in this country. Finally, the bailout bill created a bunch of other agencies or entities to oversee what's going on with the TARP funds. There's a special inspector general in the Treasury Department. There's a congressional oversight panel. There's a financial stability oversight board. So there's an incredible number of entities here. So what's the plan to deal with all this? Well, Treasury Secretary Geithner said that we need stronger, we need better, smarter, tougher regulation. And his plan has basically 5 points to it. First, they plan to create a new regulator, almost a super regulator, to monitor and be responsible for the stability of large financial entities that are too big to fail. These are, that they create systemic risk. and so therefore there's a need to regulate them in a special way. He didn't say which agency would do this, but all signs point to the Federal Reserve Board. Secondly, he wants to enforce more conservative capital requirements for financial institutions, better balance sheets. Third, he wants to regulate hedge funds and other private pools of capital, such as venture capital funds of a certain size. And he wants them to regulate with to register with the Securities and Exchange Commission. Fourth, he wants to create a new regulatory framework for derivative markets and to strengthen the SEC's regulation of money market mutual funds. And finally, to empower the federal government to take over major non-bank financial services institutions like AIG, which they don't have the power to do, unlike banks. So, this is the plan. Now, I think we can discuss whether this is going to work, but here are some of the issues that I'll just tick them off real quickly, and then I'll turn it over to my co-panelists. Will this work? That's the mega issue. How should the current fragmented regulatory structure be reorganized and consolidated? Should the SEC and the CFTC be combined, for example? Will the SEC, whose reputation has been severely tarnished by the Bernie Madoff scandal and by the failure to regulate the investment banks, be subordinated to this new super regulatory agency under this plan? Would this swing the pendulum too far in the direction of overregulation? Will it create an overly powerful regulator? If the Fed is to take this role, will it somehow undermine its independence in making monetary policy? What about the need for international regulation? We have a globalized financial services system now. Who would assume that role, if anybody? Will Congress ever consent to this, given the fact that there are a lot of turf issues in Congress concerning congressional committee oversight over all these different entities? What about the need to regulate credit rating companies like Moody's and Standard & Poor's, which did such a poor job in forecasting and rating the bonds and other debt instruments of Bear Stearns and these other companies that were about to melt down? And what about the mortgage crisis? We haven't focused on that enough. Do we need regulatory reform in the area of HUD, the VA, and these GSEs? And finally, are we putting the cart before the horse? Should we create a, as has been proposed, a congressional blue ribbon commission like the 9/11 commission to try to figure out the root causes of this financial crisis and to come up with recommendations for change before we legislate in this area? So, sorry for going on too long, but.
Thank you, Mr. Mahoney.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I'm General Counsel of the Council of Institutional Investors, and we represent about 130 public, corporate, and pension funds from across the country. Like every other association in Washington, D.C., we've been just trying to keep up with what seems to be a daily pronouncement by the government as to how we're addressing this crisis. So we've been holding teleconferences for our members, bringing in experts from Capitol Hill and from Treasury and elsewhere, kind of give them an update as to where it's going and educate them on the issues. We also produced a white paper last fall by Professor Larry Cunningham of GW Law School, focused mainly on the March 2008 Paulson blueprint, as referred to earlier, and kind of looked at that blueprint from an investor perspective, gave pros and cons on various proposals that were contained within the original Treasury blueprint. In addition, our members asked us to hold a special conference. We usually hold two conferences a year, but we held a special conference just on the crisis back in January here in Washington, where we had members of Congress, former and current regulators, members from Wall Street, business journalists, and others talk about their view of how the crisis occurred and what the resolution of that crisis should be. In addition, we have put together an investor working group so that investors actually have some input into the process that's going on here in Washington about how to reform. That group is co-chaired by two former SEC chairmen, William Donaldson and Arthur Levitt. And it took us a while to pull this group together. It includes prominent investors from around the country as well as other policymakers, and some academics and others. So that group is beginning to meet now with the goal of issuing a set of recommendations, which we'll then deliver to Congress and other policymakers sometime in May. In the meantime, our members believe that there's at least two critical parts to this reform, and we sent a letter to members of Congress back in December, and I've been going up to the Hill ever since then to discuss these issues. The two general points are, one, that however we rearrange the boxes, as discussed earlier, however we do that, we have to maintain somewhere within our structure an independent regulatory body that has as its focus investor protection. You know, we really only have one regulator in Washington who has that in its mission statement right now, and that's the Securities and Exchange Commission. There's no question that they made a number of mistakes, but rather than minimize the one body in the federal government that supports investors, we ought to improve the SEC, give it the funding it needs, the resources it needs. We've got to get the right people there in order to promote investors' interest, because if we minimize the SEC or eliminate them, there's not going to be anyone in this town other than the Council of Institutional Investors and a few others that are up on Capitol Hill telling members of Congress, telling people at Treasury, telling others in the government investor views on this. So that group's in process, hope to have a report. Our investors working group hope to have the report in May. But in the meantime, as I indicated, we've been focusing mainly on two points with members of Congress, the first being the need for this independent regulator with a focus on investor protection. If you don't want to call it the SEC or something else, that's fine, but we need to have that, and it needs to be prominent within the structure. The second point we've been focusing on, which I think is a very important one, is that as part of this reform, one thing we need to do is enhance investor rights. I think we can all agree that there's been some lack of oversight in our system, in our financial system, and that needs to be improved. Certainly one way to do that is to improve those aspects of the federal government that have oversight. But another cost-effective way to enhance oversight of financial service firms and other public companies is to enhance share owner rights so that they can exercise the appropriate level of oversight over the boards of directors of these companies. Right now, that ability to exercise oversight is quite inhibited. Our corporate law system in the United States is not a democratic-type system. Board members do not get reelected based on majority vote, just like members of Congress do. Instead, the default provision in Delaware, where most companies are incorporated, is a plurality voting system. So therefore, members can be reelected and continually reelected, even though most of the owners of those companies may withhold their vote for the election of directors. So I don't think most Americans realize it, but in the system of voting for board of directors, we don't have a democratic system today. Some other countries do. Let's change that. Let's change a couple other things as well to fix the voting system, which is the basis of shareholder rights in this country, is to elect board members. So let's fix that with majority voting. Let's also give share owners some access to the proxy. You know, companies send out the proxy card, which we, the owners, pay for. And in order for share owners to get a candidate on that card to be voted on by the owners, it's a very cumbersome and very costly process to go through. Even though we as owners pay for that proxy card, we ought to be able to more easily get some candidates on that proxy card to be voted on, to the extent that we are able to vote out a director and the company keeps putting up the same types of people. We ought to have the opportunity to get someone else on that board who will listen to investors and do something, have oversight of that company that is consistent with the long-term interests of investors. The third issue related to director voting, which needs reform, is one that the SEC just recently, under new chairman Mary Shapiro, put out a proposal on. It's something that Chairman Cox, though we asked a number of times, he refused to even put it out for comment. And that is a change to a New York Stock Exchange rule that's been in place for a long, long time that allows brokers who hold shares for the actual share owners or beneficial owners to vote those shares for the election of directors and other purposes, even when they don't receive instructions of how to vote by the actual share owners. So we have a system right now where we have brokers making these votes. They don't own the shares. They don't have the long-term interests of the company in mind. When you look at the statistics, they often vote for management. So we've called this over the years stuffing the ballot for management choices. And to her great credit, Chairman Shapiro has exposed this for comment. The comment period is going to end very shortly, and we hope that she will put that, the SEC will put that in place very quickly, though the proposed effective date is not till January of next year, so it wouldn't have any impact on this year's voting of directors. We think, given that this has been an issue for over 15 years, that we think it ought to be effective as soon as approved by the SEC so that we can fix this stuffing of the ballot for this year's proxy votes, which are very important votes for our members given the crisis. With that, I will stop now, other than to say that if you want to hear more about the financial crisis and financial accounting and reporting, or want to hear me rant about that, every Thursday night from 8 to 10, I teach law and accounting here at American University, and I will be ranting about that this semester, so feel free to take my class if you're interested in hearing a crazy accountant rant about those things. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me today. This is such an exciting time to be interested in following bank regulation. I applaud all of you for coming and for being interested in this. This, to me, of course, is something that I think is just an exciting field to pursue. And at this point in our history, really gives people the opportunity to change policy on the ground level. And when I say ground level, I really mean that seriously, because I'm somebody who actually had a career mostly in bank regulation on the federal side. And when the market started to turn down and we started to see the harms of subprime and foreclosures starting to rise, the governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, called me and with some bit of foresight thought that things were going to be getting worse and asked if I wanted to be the banking commissioner of Maryland. And this, again, I was not that well-versed, really, in regulation at the state level. And I have since grown to really appreciate it and to see its potential and, most importantly, its potential in this current crisis. What do I do? And I'll move into sort of the bigger themes that we're discussing today through that venue. But what I do is what 49 other commissioners in the country do. Every state has a banking commissioner, and as Professor Lubbers points out, we have a dual banking system in our country. So every financial institution that is a bank or a credit union can choose a state charter or a federal charter. And that's considered an extremely important feature and a very old feature in our system. If an institution chooses a state charter, it is, as Professor Lubbers points out, regulated at the state level with federal regulation as a backup. If an institution chooses a federal charter, that institution is regulated by essentially Treasury, the OCC or the OTS, with no state backup. The states do more than regulate banks and credit unions. We also are the repository, so to speak, of all the financial institutions that really don't have a charter. So, for example, the mortgage lenders, mortgage originators, mortgage servicers, all regulated by the states. Trust companies, state charter. Debt management companies, debt collectors, pawnbrokers, check cashers. A lot of these institutions are regulated also by the state level. So this makes a certain amount of sense. because there are literally thousands of these entities, and the states can be positioned, if they set up their structures, their regulatory structures correctly, can be the responders, the first responders in terms of any kind of emerging crisis and emerging issue. And when you think of emerging issues, you have to realize that the states, for all the problems with regulation, and we can, you know, point fingers all over the place, but one feature that is indisputable is that the states did respond earlier than the feds in terms of identifying predatory lending and some of the troublesome crises here. 40 states at this point have passed predatory lending laws. Look at the federal government and you won't see one yet. And that isn't at all to cast blame. It's in essence to say that there's a structure here that works probably the way it should from the perspective of having a state be able to see a problem emerging early and act on it in a proactive way. You know, federal legislation usually works in a different way. It identifies a problem. It studies a problem. It then determines what the best response is, and through a compromise and a coming together solves a problem, but often too late. And I think that that's what we've seen in a lot of ways in this current crisis that we're dealing with. In terms of structure, the financial regulatory structure is clearly going to change. I mean, there is no question but that Congress is debating how the boxes here should all be shifted and moved around, and it's an extremely important debate. And I think it's tempting, given the complexity, again, that Professor Lubbers describes, it's very tempting to say, with all this complexity, let's forget it and just create one. Let's create one simple federal monolithic regulator. And I have to say that temptation should be resisted. A single federal regulator, as simple as it sounds, is really not going to be the salvation here. I don't think it would have solved the current, or it wouldn't have prevented the current crisis, and it clearly would not, in my estimation, prevent future ones from happening. Complexity in our system is clearly a feature, and what I think of when I think of the complexity, I think that it's important because it acts as, if it's done correctly, it should act as an appropriate set of checks and balances. In other words, if you create a regulatory structure correctly, you will create a system that can check each other's parts. That's accountability. That is what we want to aim for when we redesign the current regulatory system. We want to make sure that there are appropriate checks and balances built in. And if we do it correctly, we should be able to achieve that. This, of course, is a model, you know, that really embodies the American dynamic of checks, in, you know, state-to-state checks and then state-to-federal checks. And that's something that really is Madisonian theory, you know, behind separated powers, that, you know, you want a design that's going to restrain ambitions, prevent capture by specific factions, and avert corruption. And, you know, Madison thought that the very definition of tyranny was the collapse of all powers into one. So again, this is something I think we want to work against. In that regard, we have started work in this area. I call this model, it's called cooperative federalism. We've started to rebuild the mortgage regulatory system, and the way we did this is through a federal-state cooperative structure where Congress passed a law. President Bush signed it into law in June of last year. And essentially, this law sets minimum mortgage lending and mortgage origination standards. Okay, so the federal government has set minimum standards. The states are permitted to add on to those standards, should they wish, but the states must follow those minimum standards. And we, at the state level, are required to regulate the mortgage lending industry in accordance with those standards. So we I think are going to benefit from the improved enforcement of mortgage lending from the perspective of being able to watch what's going on in every state. No state will be a safe haven for any bad apples in the mortgage business. We won't have a race to the bottom. We'll all be coordinated. But should there be states that want to innovate or do some new things regarding consumer protection, those features can be added on. So this notion of cooperative federalism is one that I think is worth pursuing. We've done it, again, we're building it in the mortgage context, and I'd like to see it work in various other realms of the bank regulatory system. The other thing I want to point out in terms of the structure is something to keep in mind as you read the headlines and you watch the crisis unfold. It clearly, you know, the crisis has clearly prompted a dramatic response from the federal government. But the short-term result of many of these programs, including the TARP, which you've heard discussed, has really been focused on the money center institutions, the big banks, Citi, B of A, U.S. Bank Corp, Wachovia, Wells Fargo, the large institutions. But most of the institutions in this country are not those institutions. And clearly, you know, the policymakers have had to do what they've had to do. I mean, I don't fault the general thrust of these interventions at all from a systemic risk perspective. But we do want to keep our eye on the fact that we do not want to create even larger institutions as a collateral byproduct of these actions, and we don't want to create institutions that are too large to fail. If you think back of the in the week September 15th, which was a dramatic week for bank regulators because you had, you know, you had Lehman Brothers, AIG, Bear Stearns, and the market tank all in 3 days. And, you know, investment banks turn in their charters for bank holding company charters. And it was a dramatic week. But if you think through, you know, think through what happened during that week, you can see that there was, and the federal responses continue to be to combine, to actually make institutions bigger. Bank of America now has merged with Merrill Lynch. That is a huge institution. I can tell you from a regulatory and examination perspective, the examiners couldn't even examine Bank of America. To now have Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, I don't have a huge degree of confidence that an institution that big, that complex, can be examined. So I think we need to really think through some of the consequences of the big actions that we've been taking, again, while very well-meaning and thrusts in the right direction, they are creating very large institutions. We do not want institutions that are too big to fail. And with that, I'll stop.
On the panel and see if anyone has any responses to what's been said, and then we'll open it up for questions. So we'll start with Professor Lovers. Do you have any response? Mr. Mahoney?
I'd just say Professor Lubber, what he talked about, whether how much of blame we should assign to Washington, to Wall Street. I think I would make it around 80-20 Wall Street, Washington, or 90-10. Only because a lot of what Washington has done and a lot of the continuing policymaking is heavily influenced by Wall Street and the other members of the financial services industry. So I think Washington is doing this on their own right now. You don't know Washington very well. I'm up on the Hill almost every week, and I can tell you the financial services industry has a huge influence as to both what Congress is doing and what the Obama administration is doing. The second issue that I want to bring up with respect to the initial TARP, and the initial plan was to buy back the assets. And I believed then, as I believe now, that one reason why they didn't go that direction was pressure from the financial services industry not to do that. And why? Because if you start putting marks, if you start buying those back, that creates some marks as to what the values are. And that leads to massive write-downs by the financial institutions holding similar instruments, which would have shown who was insolvent and who wasn't. And it would also had significant pressure on the financial institution regulators to take regulatory capital actions as well. So I think that's why, or that's one of the key reasons why the original plan was not implemented. And it's going to be interesting to see now that they're saying again that they're going to buy back assets, of how they determine those prices. You talked about an auction. It's going to be interesting to see how that works. And remember, or the way it sounds to me, we're also providing guarantees along with these. So then how does that work? Do you have to haircut the price given the government guarantee that's attached to it? In any event, I can guarantee you there's going to be a lot of arguments surrounding what those values are, how the changes in value are reported, and what impact that has on the actions of the regulators.
I did think of something, actually, in response to Jeff as well. My question for Commissioner Raskin is, in the dual banking system, you have the institutions being able to choose whether to be regulated by the state or the feds, and I'm just wondering whether or not there's some good aspects of that, but it also creates kind of a forum shopping opportunity so that you can sort of seek out the least effective or weakest regulator. If you're in a state that has very weak regulation, for example, you might choose the state if you're a bank, or you know, if you're in a state that has strong regulation, you might try to choose the OCC, especially since I think the courts have ruled that OCC regulation can preempt state regulation. So that's my question for you. Just one quick response to Jeff. With respect to the original purpose of buying up the toxic assets, I think the issue was, you know, how can you put a value on that now? So I think there needs to be some sort of an auction mechanism. Absolutely. To put a value on it. And there are certainly a lot of people out there who are looking to make money on this, and with the government's backing, it's 85% risk-free to buy these things, and so there's going to be a lot of money made if you have the money to invest, and there are these so-called vulture investors out there who are looking to make some money on this.
Sure. I think that's just, it's an excellent observation, and those the points about competition and laxity, which is what you point out, and preemption, are really quite linked to some perspective. The competition and laxity point is one that we've heard before, and essentially it says that because there's a choice in charter, an institution will seek the lowest regulator, the weakest regulator.
The race to the bottom.
In theory, I think that is possible. I've got to say, at least in terms of my tenure doing state regulation, I have not seen it. I've seen it actually move the other way, to tell you the truth. I've seen institutions that want to take advantage of the preemption doctrine to move away from a state regulator to a federal regulator. First of all, as a practical matter, state examiners and federal examiners work hand in hand. So anytime a group of bank examiners goes out to visit and do an examination of a state chartered bank, federal regulators are there with them. So and they are applying the same standards. They are applying using the same examination manual in terms of examining the institution, and they come up with one examination report. So I think the opportunities to game the system are in practice quite minimized. But the preemption point is a really important one, because what is going on, and some of you might have followed this, but Justice Ginsburg wrote an opinion for the Supreme Court in the case of Waters versus Wachovia. And this was a seminal case in terms of bank regulation, because this situation was that Wachovia Bank, which is a national bank, it has opted for a national charter, had a wholly owned subsidiary that engaged in mortgage lending, actually subprime mortgage lending, but that's not particularly relevant, but mortgage lending. And the state of Michigan is where this mortgage lender was located. And the state of Michigan's examiners, Linda Waters, who was then the commissioner in Michigan, went in to examine the wholly owned subsidiary of Wachovia, and was told by the OCC, the regulator of the parent company of Wachovia, that the state had no jurisdiction over that over that subsidiary. So the question for the Supreme Court was, does the National Bank Act preclude state examiners from examining wholly owned subsidiaries of national banks? And the court concluded that as a wholly owned subsidiary of the national bank, Wachovia, that the states were precluded from regulating and examining the wholly owned subsidiary. And this turned out to be critically important because at this point, all states had to back off and say, okay, in adherence to this decision, we no longer can go in and examine a lot of mortgage companies that happen to be set up as wholly owned subsidiaries. Now, if they are set up in different ways, the states, depending on their appetite for you know, taking on possible legal action, have decided either to go in and examine or not. That has been an issue because a lot of national banks have decided that an easy way to evade state regulation has been, in essence, to create a wholly owned subsidiary to engage in mortgage kind of activities or really any kind of banking activity. That has kept the state regulators from being able to examine these institutions, which from my perspective is not good because, again, I think another set of eyes over these entities would have been a good thing. Even more troubling has been the extension or the expansion of the Waters decision into really what I think are not at all preemptible situations. So, for example, one thing we're dealing with in Maryland has to do with H&R Block. H&R Block has entered into a contract with HSBC, which is a national bank, to issue refund anticipation loans. I don't know if anybody knows what those are, but essentially if you are pretty tight on cash and you can't really wait to get your refund back, your tax refund back from the IRS, you can go to H&R Block and H&R Block will arrange for you to get your money, you know, in 2 days or so, and then H&R Block will collect on the back end once your refund comes in. The interesting issue here has been that the fees charged by H&R Block are really quite usurious and have really hurt a lot of people. And plus, if the refund doesn't come in at exactly the same amount, you're subject to additional fees. And a lot of people are actually getting hurt by this. So some states have gone in to try to regulate, under current authority, H&R Block in terms of the fees and the disclosures they charge. Well, Maryland did this, went in to regulate H&R Block, just to ask them to register with the state, very, very light. But essentially, H&R Block said, look, you can't touch us under, you know, Waters v. Wachovia. You can't touch us. And we sort of scratched our heads thinking, well, wait a minute, how does Waters v. Wachovia, you're not a wholly owned subsidiary of HSBC, of the National Bank. How can you claim this? But they have claimed it. They claim, well, they have a contract. They have a contract with a national bank. And so they are now trying to extend this preemption into not just a wholly owned subsidiary of a bank, of a national bank, but a contract with a national bank. This is very distressing because this really is going to keep states from doing much, to tell you the truth, in terms of regulating a lot of financial behavior. So that's an example, sort of a timely example of what preemption deals with, but it is from my perspective, it actually encourages institutions to become national banks.
And that would also prevent states from enforcing predatory lending laws, and you said there's nothing like that on the federal level as well.
That's exactly right. So it would keep states out of enforcing predatory lending laws. Now, just to keep you completely up to date on this, there is a case where cert has been granted, Cuomo versus the National Clearinghouse, where a state where New York is looking at examining fair lending laws in New York. And has been told by the lower courts that they cannot, that that's preempted. And the Supreme Court has agreed to take that case. And it's going to be argued, I think, April 15th.
We'll see.
It is a good day. It's also my birthday.
Well, I guess I'll start off, unless there are any other responses at the moment, I'll start off with a question to kind of give everyone a chance to think if they have any other questions to follow up with. And my question is stepping back a little bit and looking at the reorganization of agencies. And Treasury has proposed this independent agency to regulate financial institutions that are systemically important, whereas, you know, currently they're organized as bank regulators along basically what the function of the institution is. Now, my question to the panel is, what do you believe the distinction should be, and do you believe the ultimate result will be that regulations will be less stringent for smaller institutions, thus encouraging them to remain smaller?
Well, I'll just I don't think the Treasury plan intends for the smaller institutions to then escape regulation. I think they would be still be regulated by the whatever institutions regulate them now. Treasury hasn't really said how the who's going to do that and how the boxes are going to be rearranged. I think they want to get the authority to do this kind of regulation first and then figure out who's going to do it. I guess one question is, what is an institution that creates systemic risk? I mean, what are these institutions? Are we talking about AIG? Are we talking about General Motors? Corporations that reach a certain size and have a lot of employees and suppliers? Or are we just talking about purely financial institutions like the investment banks were? I'm not really clear on that. I'll just stop there.
I'm not clear on it either. The council doesn't have any position on this. As I mentioned earlier, we do have an investor working group chaired by former SEC Chairman Donaldson Levitt that I expect will probably look at this issue as part of their review of the various proposals. Looking at this more broadly, just my personal view is there's a lot of talk that the Federal Reserve be this systemic risk regulator at the top. I have some concerns about that because they also have a regulatory role. What I'm most concerned about is whoever this systemic risk regulator, are they then going to be able to go to the individual regulators, assuming we still have other individual regulators, and mandate that they take some action or not take some action? I think that's of concern to our members. Again, assuming somewhere in this set of boxes we're going to have an independent regulator that focuses on investor protection, what I would be concerned about is a systemic risk regulator. They then are able to go to that regulator and either mandate that they do something or prevent them from doing something. I think that would be very problematic, particularly if the Fed or, for that matter, any other group had that responsibility, because I think what will happen or what could happen, the risk that I'm concerned about, is that one regulator that has its focus on investor protection will be overridden by the systemic risk regulator that may have a focus on bank stability or safety and soundness, and its concerns about investors is much lower down the list. I'd be concerned about that regulator controlling the regulator that has a focus on investor protection. I think investors will ultimately lose if that's the process that's set up.
These are critical questions. Now, remember, what is systemically important? Those are the institutions that, in the common vernacular, are too big to fail. That's AIG. That's possibly B of A and Citi. These are the institutions whose linkages with other institutions are so intertwined and complex that you can't bring, if you bring one down, you bring down whole sectors of the economy. Not that that can be a formal definition, but the issue is that they're going to have to be identified. Systemically important institutions are going to have to be identified. And the identification process itself is going to create what we call moral hazard. In other words, because they're too big to fail. So what does it even mean to regulate them? What's going to be the teeth in terms of enforcement if they're too big to fail? If they never can fail, what exactly, you know, here are the carrots, but where are the sticks? So that's the risk, in this whole process of identifying what is systemically important. And I think the way, this isn't like a full answer, but I think the way through this is by, is through capital requirements. So in other words, because these institutions can't fail, and we've identified them as institutions that can't fail, we're going to have to impose very high capital standards. What is capital? Capital is the, you know, the really the bones, the financial wherewithal behind an institution that permits it to honor its obligations. Clearly, a lot of these institutions, AIG was never really regulated in that, from a capital perspective. If it becomes an institution that is systemically important, too big to fail, it's going to need to put up significant amounts of capital. And I think that that's probably one way we're going to have to move through this is through capital requirements.
I also see a couple of other potential problems here. I mean, if the criteria for what is too big to fail is objective and it's written down, then you're going to have a lot of companies trying to keep just below that level or use creative methods to break themselves up so that they don't become that big. If it's purely subjective, then you're going to get into all sorts of disputes about whether or not the Fed or whoever's doing the identification has done it correctly. There's no end of creativity in Wall Street to figure out new types of entities. You know, the AIG was just an old line insurance company and probably would still be profitable today if it didn't have this little financial products
affiliate
tacked onto it, which was doing all the credit default swaps, which then was incredibly leveraged, which sunk the whole company. So, you know, I mean, that little piece, if that had been, that was what was too big to fail, it became too big to fail. It was like this little, I don't know, it was like a leech that got under the company and just got really huge. So I'm just full of questions on this. I don't really see the answer.
But you answered it the first time when you said that it doesn't mean if you're right below the limit, you're still going to be regulated. It's
yes.
Not as if there's going to be an absence of regulation for the institutions that are
but if there are new tougher capital requirements, if you're above the level, then everybody's going to try to stay below the level.
Unless you toughen capital requirements throughout.
What Professor Schwartz? But what about something like General Motors, which now we're almost considering too big to fail for other reasons, not because they're financially intertwined with other financial institutions, but because they have too many suppliers. Which they're doing with the TARP money now. Well, that sounds like what the way this is going to be written, too.
I don't think so. I think they've actually talked about the danger of systemic failure. They said they will increase capital requirements. That's one of the consequences of this. And for a while, they'll be gun-shy, and they will probably enforce it rigorously. And then agency capture will
That's right. This is not a, you know, this problem that we're dealing with now is not something that just happened one summer. I mean, this has been building and building through a number of different policy and regulatory actions. And if you think about it, we got to a place where we have too big to fail, where we have these massive bailouts. again, this is my opinion, but, you know, we had sort of three factors. One, we had a very, we allowed for this complexity when we repealed Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall was the statute that kept banking and commerce separate, but we repealed that, and we permitted insurance to affiliate with banking, to affiliate with investment banking, to even affiliate with real estate. So we repealed Glass-Steagall. We decided on a course of weak antitrust enforcement, so we did let institutions grow without a real antitrust check on them. And thirdly, we really cultivated a weak regulatory posture. I mean, there was every law that was going through Congress was a deregulation statute. There was nothing new in terms of new controls in place. Any one of these things, from my perspective, you know, is pretty dangerous. This country took all three together, and that's the story of, you know, the 80s and 90s. Are those three ingredients all together, and I think that's what got us here. And it's important to think about that as we try to craft solutions to how we get out of it, because I think that the solutions come from understanding the causes.
Yeah, let's see if there are questions. Go ahead.
Kind of a follow-up on this too big to fail on cost. Do you think they'll try to reinstate some of those regulations that they've taken away so that we'll go back to stopping these from coming too big to fail? And how, is there some way where they can take the companies that are too big to fail and trade them up so that, I mean, is there, are those just perpetually going to be too big to fail?
Standard Oil was broken up in the early 20th century, but
I think you're asking just the bullseye question. I mean, and I can't say I know the answer. I mean, the I think that we should be, from the banking side, we should be trying to look at these institutions and see what can be spun off. So we should be taking Bank of America. And, of course, this isn't what we've done. We've just forced a marriage between Bank of America and Merrill Lynch. But, okay, let's say we put that chapter behind us and figure out ways in which we can spin off affiliates, spin off business lines. I would be all in favor of seeing that. I think we need to reinvigorate antitrust enforcement. There are antitrust laws that govern marriages of banks and other institutions. I don't know why this stuff wasn't enforced, but it wasn't. And I think we need to reinforce. I think that's an easy one. We should certainly stop the continued growth of these institutions in a way. I'm not like anti-growth, but I am anti doing anything that I don't understand. And I'm telling you, the regulators cannot understand what is going on in terms of these new instruments. People were told, oh, credit default swaps, yes, there are some, you know, MIT PhDs who completely understand this. The examiners didn't understand them. And I think if you can't explain it to an examiner, you're going to have a problem.
What is it about the FIRST Act that I'm not specifically familiar with that act?
Well, 98, when they basically allowed.
Okay. All right, that was when Wendy Graham was the chair of the CFTC?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's. I don't know the specifics of that, but I'm sure it's a classic tale of, you know, lobbying influence of the industry on Washington and getting laws passed that had a lot of consequences that weren't understood by the legislators when they passed the law. I mean, the whole CFTC-SEC division seems a little bit fuzzy to me because, you know, originally the CFTC was supposed to regulate options such as, you know, corn futures and pork bellies and things like that, and now they're regulating all these financial services instruments and stock indexes and things that are, you know, otherwise within the purview of the SEC. So, I mean, I think there's a pretty good argument for combining those two agencies, if nothing else. But so I think it's just that that first one is just a classic tale of special interest lobbying that worked for the industry and didn't work for the rest of the country. And you can speak about usury laws, probably.
Sure. Let's see. On the Commodities Futures Act, first of all, I think that the problem there has been a lack of transparency. I actually worked for the Senate Banking Committee in the 90s, and one of the tasks I was asked to put together was a bill that was going to actually force transparency disclosure on derivatives, and drafted it. I thought it was terrific, and it, you know, pretty much sat in a drawer for about 5 years, actually still sitting in there. But clearly the lack of transparency is a huge problem. And that problem came out in a Bernanke went up to testify just a couple weeks ago, was asked about AIG, and was, you know, the question that came to him was, can you explain to us the dollar amount? What are we looking at? Some of the members said, what are we looking at in terms of the linkages between AIG and the counterparties? What is the dollar amount here? And he turned to Vice Chairman Donald Cohn behind him and was advised something and then said, I'm not permitted to talk about, you know, this cannot be discussed. Again, why not? I mean, this is huge. These are huge questions of transparency. I think we want to see transparency improved. We want to see disclosure over these instruments. There is some move to create a clearinghouse, which is possibly going to be a vehicle for getting quantifying all these derivative trades for people in a meaningful way. We have to watch and see, but you're right to point that out. We need to keep that.
Our government obviously knew the counterparts were considering our treasurer, Treasury Secretary, who's running Goldman, Sachs, and Paulson.
You mean Secretary Paulson knew?
Paulson, yes.
Yeah. I think the fear was, one, that it would create a panic. I mean, I think they thought that if they actually discussed the dollar amounts involved and the names of the institutions associated with those credit default swaps, that people would make a run on those institutions and they would collapse. Your other two, I'll just take a stab at the commercial real estate. That continues to be an issue from a bank examination perspective because the values of commercial real estate have been falling rapidly. Coupled with, you know, a lot of times this commercial real estate there's collateral that backs up the loans, and that's the form of the commercial real estate. So the loans now are under-secured, under-collateralized, which means that the institution needs to come up with more collateral. One thing that's being discussed is a change in mark-to-market accounting, which you may be able to elaborate on a bit. But there clearly is an issue there that is being monitored, but it is problematic. The usury laws, I think that's – I haven't seen the article, but I definitely would like to read it. And if there could be a consensus on a usury ceiling at the federal level, I think that would be amazing.
I can only comment on the first part of your question, and I just agree with both of my co-panelists here. I recall attending hearings back in the 90s when I was up on the Hill talking about disclosure about derivatives, and back then Brooksley Bourne was the chairman of the CFTC supporting greater regulation of over-the-counter derivatives, and she I recall, was not treated kindly by anyone, including then Secretary of Treasury Robert Rubin, then Chairman of the SEC Arthur Levitt, then Chairman of the Federal Reserve Alan Greenspan. In fact, the three of them teamed up against her.
And Rubin, too.
Yes. And Brooksley Bourne's a member of our investors working group, so I'm going to be very interested in her input into the process. But there was a large group of individuals, which included our government, who were against more regulation of over-the-counter derivatives back in the 90s.
No. Take a question, propose a question that comes a little bit more away from the overarching side, and ask, we recently read in the news about how the White House, the current administration has asked the chairman and CEO of General Motors to step down and asked the organization to basically streamline their products and things like that. What do you believe would be a good balance between enforcing investor involvement in the corporation, but at the same time making sure that their ability to run the corporation and vote on the operations of the corporation is balanced, if that made sense? Anybody has a way?
I mean, I'll start. I think that that extraordinary move is really indicates a failure of corporate governance. I was, frankly, I continue to be amazed that some of our largest financial institution CEOs continue to hold on to their jobs. The way it's supposed to work, if you believe in good corporate governance, is that the board would be, and shareholders would be removing some of these CEOs who are not delivering or are not somehow being responsive to other stakeholders. At this point in our country, the federal government is an important stakeholder, not just with the car companies, but with the banks, because they do own through this TARP process, remember, and through these capital infusions, the government owns quite a hefty share of our nation's biggest banks. And so, you know, from that perspective, I think we may see a little bit more of that in terms of CEOs being forced to leave. But it is an extraordinary move to have the president take a step like that. And I would have imagined it wouldn't have been necessary had corporate governance worked the way it was supposed to in an earlier sort of a couple months ago.
Right. I agree with that. Consistent with what I said earlier, I think if we go through this whole process and we miss the opportunity about enhancing shareholder rights in this country, I think it will be a great loss for our market system, for our regulatory system going forward. I mean, if we can't enhance shareholder rights after this crisis, I don't know when we'll ever have the opportunity. But our system is fundamentally based on disclosure. We have more disclosures than any other major market country. We enforce those disclosures better than anyone else. That said, we have a lot of problems with disclosures as well, and in enforcement of disclosures, we need improvements there. But other countries have taken the approach where they have less disclosures, less enforcement, but they have a better shareholder rights than we do. I think it's time to put those two systems together, continue with full disclosure, let's improve the disclosure, let's have good enforcement disclosure, but let's bump up shareholder rights at the same time, give shareholders the tools that they need to have effective oversight over corporate boards to take care of some of these, hopefully to take care of some of these problems before they occur next time.
All right. With that, I'm sorry, we're actually out of time for the moment, unless is there any
questions? She had a question for
you. Oh, sure, I'm sorry.
Basically, Putin had indicated that the financial solution was not sufficient whatsoever as a regional OEM, and also including the role of the Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative in Tonga and Antarctica. How do you see a financial solution as any type of answer whatsoever without systemic change? Because what I'm hearing is exactly the same, if not more restrictive than what I heard, four or five years ago.
I'm not sure I understood the first part, but I think systematic. I think everybody agrees that we need to have systematic change, and I think if anything, as Jeff just said, if this crisis doesn't produce systematic change, nothing will. So we're talking about doing things that we haven't talked about doing in this country for a long time in terms of having greater regulation of the financial services industry and I mean, nobody would have ever considered regulating systemic risk in the past as something to regulate, but now we're talking about doing that. So I think the banks are under more scrutiny than ever. So you know, I guess I would just agree in a sense with the premise of your question that we need a lot more systemic changes, and I suspect we're going to get that.
I would hope it's more than improve investor rights.
That's just a piece of it, I think.
Any other concluding remarks?
No, I agree with you. I think investor rights is an important piece. It isn't the only piece. Say, I hope our investors working group, and I'm sure they will, come out with a series of recommendations that I'm hoping are taken seriously by members of Congress and the administration. I think, as the professor said earlier, there's some controversy about whether or not we ought to have something like what is it, PCORA hearings,
9/11 commission type,
or
hearings.
A 9/11 type commission hearings. I think that's a great idea. I think to get everyone up there and to help educate the public about exactly what did occur here, who was at fault. I think that's a good idea to set the stage for doing a careful and cost-effective change, and we're definitely gonna need some change. But I think the public still doesn't fully understand why this happened and who's at fault. So let's get people up there and let's find that out. And I think that, again, that will make us. I think that will help us do a more effective way. Help us be more effective when we propose changes.
I want to call on Professor Pike. The one chance I can have the call on you. What do you think the IRS should be doing to address the situation? Are there any policy changes that the IRS could make that would help in this area? I mean, including. I suppose this wouldn't be the IRS's decision, but you know, higher taxation of bonuses and things like that—that's been proposed.
I think that there makes sense to limit, you know, compensation to corporations. Should be allowed to pay their
I'd say on compensation, I mean, before when we put that $1 million limit on compensation, that in the tax code, that just led to everyone giving a certain type of stock option, which then we've led to stock option backdating and additional violations of the Internal Revenue Code and the securities laws. Going back to my original point, if we have a fair election of directors, then I think shareholders can take care of this problem. If people are management are overcompensated, then we look to who's the chairman of that compensation committee and who's on the board of that compensation committee, and we get them out of there and get some new people in there. I think that's the most effective way to take care of it. Whenever you put anything in the code, and we've had a lot of experience with this, it leads to a lot of unintended consequences that usually end up biting us in the rear end further down the line.
So in a company like, let's say, GM, what percentage of the shares are held by average citizens like you and me?
General Motors?
Yeah, or some other company like that. I mean, I know we're talking about a fair chunk of the shares are held by the actual board members, And then you've got large institutional investors like unions and TIA Craft and things like that that hold a lot of shares. And then there's everybody else.
Right.
I'm just wondering, what percentage is the everybody else usually?
For a company like General Motors? I don't know off the top of my head, but you're right. I mean, most of our members are index investors. So there would be, in order to have a significantly large share owner group, even our largest individual member, CalPERS, the largest pension funds in the world, you know, on their own, they only have a very small percentage of companies because of their index investing. So that means they're going to have to get together with other institutional investors in order to form a sufficient number to be successful in voting out directors or taking other actions.
I mean, I'm all in favor of what your organization is pushing, and when I do my little votes on the internet, I tend to always vote for the things that are opposed by the company. But I find it, I don't know how many success stories there are out there. I mean, and maybe the current system is so skewed that it's impossible to ever change anything, but it would seem to require such a concentrated effort of getting everybody on the same page to get rid of a chairman or to lower salaries or something like that, that it just seems very difficult to do, even under the best circumstances.
It is not easy, and given some of the problems we have, it's difficult to do it, which is why we need some of these reforms. But some of our members do have very active vote no campaigns every proxy season, and some of them are quite successful, including at some of the financial institutions. For example, one of our members, as far as proposals, tried to put out a proposal for several of the financial institutions who now are owned by us, asking for more disclosures about risk management of their financial products. Management of those companies opposed those proposals, and with the SEC's support, they never got on the proxy to be voted on. So we need some changes in corporate governance so that we can get those types of things voted on, get those things out into the public so people, including individual shareholders, can be aware of them, and that we can actually have some type of democratic process in these votes, particularly the voting for directors.
Any additional questions? All right. Any concluding remarks? Okay. Well, with that, I'd like to thank our distinguished panelists for joining us. I'd like to thank Kellen and the Office of Special Events Founders Day for organizing the event, and I'd like to thank you guys for coming. And we have a few parting gifts that were left on your chairs, so thank you very much, token of our appreciation. And if anybody's interested in reading more about similar events, the Legislation and Policy Roundtable is publishing next week on a variety of issues related to changes in economic policy and law. So feel free to look for it next week. And thank you very much.